Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. Later in the show, we'll be talking with the director of a play opening this weekend in Webster City. We'd like to start the show today by turning to the fields around us. The crops are growing, farmers' markets are in full swing throughout the area, and today's program is about the future of farming, not just this year, but in years to come. We have three guests to talk to us about that topic. One is Fred Kirschenmann, former director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. The second guest is Aaron Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union. And the third is David Weisberger, a recent graduate student whose research was funded by the center. I'd like to start with Fred Kirschenmann giving us his thoughts on the future of agriculture. When you came to the Leopold Center, you brought with you a view that was even new for the Leopold Center, I believe. And could you describe what that was and why you looked at things the way you did?
Well, one of the things that the more that I became involved in agriculture, the more I began to realize that the kind of farming that, you know, conventional agriculture is doing can't continue indefinitely into the future because it's so dependent on all of these external inputs, you know, you get, and they're all cheap inputs, fossil fuels and minerals, you know, everything that a farmer uses all comes from outside the farm. So I began to wonder, you know, how we were going to feed ourselves when we no longer had all of those cheap resources to sustain that current system. And then it occurred to me increasingly that the kind of system we have to transition to is one that doesn't base on us dominating nature and forcing nature to do what we wanted her to do, but rather how can we learn from nature and partner with nature to accomplish what we want to accomplish. And then over time I began to realize that there were a number of people in our culture that already understood this, you know, already back in the early 1900s, like Liberty Hyde Bailey, who wrote a book called The Holy Earth back in 1915, in which he said that we should not be doing agriculture by trying to force nature to do what we want her to do, but rather we should treat nature as if she was sacred, and then we learn from nature. And then he also pointed out that in order to get to that point, we also have to have a new hold inside ourselves. We have to be transformed within us. What is our spiritual center? How do we decide what's important? And then although Leopold and Sir Albert Howard and others along the way had these similar views, and the more that I looked at these two cultures, you know, the one culture where we dominate nature and force nature to do what we want to do, and the other culture where we partner with nature and learn from nature. And then I also began to recognize on my own farm, and to get back to your original question about whether which is more difficult, you know, once you get a system in place that's really self-regulating and self-renewing, it's actually much easier, you know, to manage and to grow food because you don't have to, you know, do all the stuff. You just let nature do things. And that doesn't mean you ignore nature. You continue to make sure that nature gets what nature needs in order to be self-renewing and self-regulating. And it's challenging in the sense that it's different in different places. Like what I'm doing on my farm in North Dakota, you wouldn't want to do exactly the same thing in Florida or California, and probably not even in Iowa, because the ecology is different, and so you have to adapt those principles to the places where you are.
Also, with climate change, the principles are one thing, but the practical ways that nature is behaving is a different thing.
Yeah.
It's not like it was last year or 10 years ago, or like it will be 20 years from now. So what do you see as the possibility to get ready for that or to try to figure out what directions to take?
If we now, instead of imagining, you know, what we need to do to make the current system a little more efficient, that's one kind of set of issues you look at. If you look at it in terms of what do we need to do now if we're going to be able to have essentially a self-regulating and self-renewing system in the future that operates on the basis of nature and that is able to still be relatively reliable in terms of its production under the conditions of climate change. And so, you know, the way I've tried to put this in a rather simple way, and that is I think what we have to do now is transition from maximum efficient production for short-term economic return, which is the primary driver of the industrial agriculture system, to a system that's based on what I would call regenerate, the three R's, a regenerating so that everything that we use gets renewed in the process of using, resilient, that's able to still survive and thrive under these conditions of climate change, and based on relationships. In other words, this isn't just something we can say to farmers, you should go change and do this. We have to say, how do we do this together in our own ecological regions? And so I think if we focus on those three things, then, and we know already from some experiences that, to give you one example, David Montgomery has published a new book now called Growing a Revolution. And he writes this book based on, I think if I remember, it's eight farmers that he visited where he spent several weeks on each farm. But these are not organic farmers. These are farmers who are doing what he calls conservation agriculture. They reduce their tillage, they include cover crops, and they diversify their operations. And what they have found is that by making those transitions, their system becomes regenerative, resilient. And just to give you one example, Gabe Brown in North Dakota, who's one of those farmers, and his farm is actually on the just on the west side of the Missouri River, which is in the shortgrass prairie region, which is not the, the most productive soil. But he's been doing this these practices now that I just described. He's been doing that now for, I think, 12 years. And if you look at this in terms of the performance of the system, as you probably know, farmers in Iowa who raise corn and soybeans and have all these synthetic inputs, it costs them about $4 a bushel in input cost to raise corn. Gabe Brown is raising corn for $1.44 a bushel on input costs. And his soil has improved to such an extent now, instead of the soil only absorbing a half inch of rainwater an hour, which many of our soils now, the way we're managing the way we're at, his soils now absorb 8 inches of rainwater an hour. So when you have these climate variations where you have heavier rains and flooding, because the soil absorbs so much of that water, he can be back out in his fields in 2 or 3 days instead of having to wait a week or 10 days, which farmers sometimes can't get out to plant at the right time. And when there are drought periods, he has this moisture absorbed in the soil, so it still sustains his crops under those drought conditions. And so these are some examples that are starting to emerge where we're making that transition. The other thing about all of these farmers that David Montgomery visited, none of them want to get bigger anymore because the system is working so well now as a, you know, as a self-renewing system. And so I think these are some of the examples that we need to look at, and as we try to make the transitions we need to make.
The Iowa Farmers Union is one of the organizations dedicated to helping farmers develop the kind of cooperation that Fred talks about as being essential to solve the problems that will face farmers in the future. So let's talk with Aaron Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union, and David Weisberger, graduate student in sustainable agriculture and a member of the Iowa Farmers Union.
I'm Aaron Lehman. I farm in northern Polk County with my family. I'm a fifth generation farmer there. I have two kids who are going to be going to college now, and my wife is on the farm, and my father's 95 years old, and he comes out to the farm and helps out also.
And David?
My name is David Weisberger. I'm a graduate student researcher at Iowa State University. I'm housed in the Department of Agronomy, and I'm part of the Graduate Program in Sustainable Agriculture. I've done some work with Aaron on looking at some effects of management on oats, and I'm here today to talk a little bit about that and our experiences with IFU.
Well, you're both here today, I understand, because this is the kickoff day for the membership drive for the Iowa Farmers Union.
That's right. I'm the president of the Iowa Farmers Union, and I was just elected by our convention in December. And we're very excited to be offering this membership opportunity. New members who join the Farmers Union under this program, we have a generous matching program that will provide $20 of that membership to the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. You understand, of course, that the Leopold Center has been the subject of a mighty debate at the end of the legislative session that left its name intact but took away all state funding. And it was only left with the gifts that have been given to the Leopold Center over the years, those that will continue to fund the Leopold Center in a very, very scaled-down manner at this point. So as a result, we wanted to take some action and show our support for the Leopold Center, and we were able to get some generous help to do this matching program. So for every new member who joins with the Iowa Farmers Union, we'll be able to match under this program $20 to go to the Leopold Center and their great work supporting the Graduate Program for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State.
Now, matching, how does that work? That means you get the whole membership, but somebody else matches.
Yeah, it's just like your regular membership. We have a lot of wonderful benefits that go along with being an Iowa Farmers Union member. But this matching program means that not only will you get your membership like you normally would, but on top of that, a gift, if you choose, will be given to the Leopold Center. And so we're very excited about that. We think it's a good opportunity to show how valuable the Leopold Center is to farmers and to the agriculture community. At the same time, building the membership of the Farmers Union.
And so he said something about student members. You must have been a student member, David.
I am presently a student member.
And so tell us a little bit about who you are and what your relationship with the Iowa Farmers Union is.
Most particularly, I'm here because Aaron and I did some research together, and he has been a very willing and engaged cooperator in some on-farm trials. And for that, I had to be here this morning.
One of the questions that I had is, you've already started to answer that. What is the work of the Iowa Farmers Union?
Yeah.
But the other one that I have to ask, until I knew people in the Iowa Farmers Union, I didn't understand why there were two, I guess, big agriculture organizations.
Mm-hmm.
The other one being, of course, the Farm Bureau.
Sure.
And I went online and I saw that the Iowa Farmers Union is 1 or 2 years older mm-hmm. than the Farm Bureau.
That's true.
So back in 1915, when the Iowa Farmers Union was formed, agriculture was very different.
Absolutely.
A number of programs with farmers talking about hand shucking the corn mm-hmm. at Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and when their parents got the first tractor and during right. World War II.
And the national organization was in 1902.
Your national organization.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so the Iowa Farm Bureau obviously started shortly after you did.
Mm-hmm.
What were the issues in agriculture that caused them to start then when you were already basically covering the issues for farmers?
Well, I won't be able to fully cover exactly the origins of the Farm Bureau, but I will tell you that the Farmers Union was started largely out of a group of farmers who felt that they needed to work together in order to achieve their goals on the farm. At that time, the cooperative movement was just getting started. There weren't in place a lot of the legislative and framework that there is now that allows farmers to work together. But at that time, the farmers realized that in order for them to get a fair price for their product, they were much better off if they worked together than if they did individually. And so at that time, they started organizing. And they figured that It would be important for them to act as a group rather than as individuals if they wanted to get fair prices for their product, if they wanted to get fair, even a fair measurement for the product when they took to town. Who owns the scales? Whose pound is being used when you're measuring a pound of wheat back in 1902, or a pound of cotton with the Farmers Union origins? So what is it that the so they took it upon themselves to work together to collaboratively, in some cases even own the operation that they were buying their inputs from or selling their products to. In addition to that, they realized that the law was not sufficient to allow them to work together properly. So they started working on legislative efforts as well, getting a framework in the law that allowed farmers to work together so that they wouldn't be discriminated if they chose to work together. That sprung into a larger legislative effort for farmers that continues on to this day. Farmers Union is probably most publicly known for our work that we do at the national and state level dealing with policy.
1902 was during the progressive movement.
That's right.
And so was this part of the progressive movement?
Oh, absolutely. It allowed a progressive movement to extend to our rural areas that lasts all the way till today, where the progressive movements in rural America stem from those origins.
Are you related then to the co-op movement?
Yes. Farmers Union has started hundreds of co-ops around the country over the years, many of those co-ops have changed form and function over the years. But their origins, even some of the largest ones that we're familiar with, had their farmers' union origins. Senex Harvest States, CHS co-op, for instance, was originally Farmers Union Central Exchange, and the names have changed and their entities have evolved over the years, but some of those larger ones had their origins with the Farmers Union. But over the years, Farmers Union was not just involved in those co-ops that we traditionally think of, input co-ops and places that will buy our product or process our product. But they were also involved in all sorts of co-ops around the country. There were cooperative hospitals throughout the South that were started from Farmers Union. Of course, credit unions came out of that same cooperative movement over the years. So the notion that farmers are better off when they work together extended not just to our legislative work, but it was very much on the ground, trying to find ways that farmers could work together to provide a real living income for farmers.
And also for rural communities?
Absolutely. This allowed rural communities to thrive rather than be at the mercy of the corporate-owned entities in the major cities.
Well, how many members do you have here in Iowa?
Yeah, we have about 600 members nationwide. We have about 200,000 members, we're a federation of farmers' union divisions around the country.
Now, I have another question that I think a lot of our members would be confused if they don't pay a lot of attention to farmers. That there is another organization, Iowa Farm Bureau,
sure,
that is more often in the news,
mm-hmm,
and is, I think, often also involved with legislation.
Absolutely.
And they, I think, have 159,000 members. Now, where did that organization come from? What were the what are the issues that that separate you?
Well, I won't be able to speak completely on the origins of the Farm Bureau as well, but so I would have to leave that to someone who has a little bit more of a unbiased background than I do. But there are big policy differences between the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union. Although I would say that we try very hard to work together as much as we can to promote those issues that we do have in common. And we make every effort to do that because we do think it's better if agriculture has a united voice whenever possible. We know that agriculture and rural America has a smaller and smaller share of the voting bloc in this country, and it's continuing to decrease. So whenever possible, we work together. But we do depart on some issues, and those are important, and those sometimes get a lot of attention. Farmers Union would be nowhere where it is today without having a family focus and without the leadership of women in the farm movement over the decades. So we've been very progressive in that front. And of course, we're talking a lot about Medicaid and Medicare these days because those topics are so much in the news. Farmers Union was extremely involved in the creation of those institutions for our country that are so important to farmers and to rural America. So we've been involved in those things for many, many years. And we continue to work on progressive issues on the agriculture front as well. We bring farmers to Washington, D.C. every year as citizen lobbyists. And this last September when we brought folks to Washington, we were not only working on things like ethanol, which there is some broad support in the broader agriculture community, but we were also working on things like fair trade, making sure that our trade agreements represent the interests of ordinary working farmers or ordinary working people, and instead of only representing the larger corporate interests that often prevail in trade agreements. Unfortunately, the model for trade agreements over the past 20 years has put those interests above the interests of ordinary working people. For instance, one issue that we have worked very, very hard on over the decades is a method to allow our farmers to show their pride by putting a label on our food product that says this is grown in the United States, country of origin labeling. And we feel that if we do that, we are able to give consumers a choice for the food that they buy. And we were successful in passing this legislation. And implementation was well on its way, and it still is in place for some products. But for other products in the livestock industry and the poultry industry, there were objections brought up that putting a label on our product would violate our trade agreements that largely came out of the NAFTA trade agreement and the other ones that followed it. And who brought these arguments? Well, our neighbors, but not only them, but they were joined by the meat packers. And they all decided that that would be a violation of trade practices. And it's simply wrong that our food policy can be subject to a trade agreement that had very little way to reconcile differences in a fair and straightforward and transparent manner. So under the threat of trade sanctions, after going through the process, our Congress was forced to back down, and we no longer have country of origin labeling on our meat. That's simply wrong. We really ought to have trade agreements that encourage countries to develop their own national food policy. And that's not happening now. In addition to working on that issue, we were also working on the preliminary talks about this upcoming Farm Bill. Farm Bill discussions are well underway, and we are looking to broaden the safety net for farmers in this farm bill. We're looking to expand the conservation programs in this next farm bill. We're looking for reforms in the farm bill so that we are targeting our benefits to family-sized farmers and not encouraging a consolidation of farms in Iowa. So those are the issues that we're working on. We have grassroots folks who are knocking on door to door in Washington to make a real difference and let them know that we need farm policy that reflects the needs of family farmers in rural communities.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Aaron Lehman and David Weisberger, members of the Iowa Farmers Union. I'm your host, Susan Franzen. And when I was talking with these Iowa farmers, I was struck by the fact that although they have had different life experiences, what Aaron and David have in common with Fred Kirschenmann is the value they place on small grains. Let's hear from Fred about why he plants small grains on his farm in North Dakota.
And for my organic farm up in North Dakota.
And how large is that and what do you produce?
Well, 2,000 acres now. Yeah, and we produce mostly small grains and livestock.
And why did you choose to do that?
Well, the reason we raise small grains and livestock because in that part of North Dakota, this is the prairie pothole region. So about 900 acres of our farm is still a native prairie because it's not suitable for crop production. So that, you know, encourages you to do livestock. And the crop production, when we decided to convert to an organic farm, we knew we needed to have a diverse crop rotation. And so we always raise some alfalfa, which we use for forages for the livestock in the winter months. And the alfalfa provides the restoring the biological health of our soil and the nitrogen that we need, et cetera. And then we usually raise three or four cash crops, and then we go back to another 2 or 3 years of alfalfa.
But why did you decide to do organic farming? Isn't it more expensive or more difficult?
No, the transition was difficult, but I did that primarily because I started my career in higher education, and I learned about organic farming actually from one of my students. And I was impressed with the difference it made in soil, that's a longer story about how that the value of the importance of taking care of soil was for me, but partly my father, because my father and mother started farming our farm in 1930, right after they got married, and that was still in the heart of the Dust Bowl. And my father somehow understood that the Dust Bowl wasn't just about the weather, which most of his neighbors thought. It was also about the way farmers farmed, and that therefore he wanted to be sure that that never ever happened to his land again. And so he became a big advocate of taking care of land. And to me, managing your soil for soil health is one of the ways of taking care of land. So that became important for me.
Now let's hear from Aaron Lehman and David Weisberger. You mentioned that you had worked with Aaron.
Yeah, the research that we did on our farm was really fascinating. I farm around 200 acres organically on our farm. We also have some conventional acres as well. But when it comes to small grains, we haven't been doing as a state, and our research institutions haven't been doing a lot of work on small grains over the past 40 years. As small grains have started to vanish from the landscape, our focus on our research institutions have been more on corn and soybeans. And as a result, for us who are trying to implement some long-term rotations, I have oats in my organic rotation, for instance, we just don't have the resources that gives us some basic knowledge about what it takes to grow good small grains in Iowa. And it's a challenge to grow good small grains in Iowa. Our weather and climate and our soils are challenging to do that well.
Why is the wonderful, rich Iowa soil not good for small grains? And could you tell us, list a few other small grains?
Well, I'll let David go into that because he's much more knowledgeable about it. But
so small grains in Iowa include oats, barley, wheat, triticale, and rye. Right, so at one point in Iowa, there were over 6.5 million acres of oats. But if we go back further than that, there were large acres of wheat and rye and barley. So that has obviously changed. The acreage now in Iowa for oats, for instance, which is the dominant small grain still in Iowa, is closer to 43,000 acres. So that's more than a 100-fold reduction over a 60-year period. So what's challenging about Iowa and growing small grains, as Aaron mentioned, is the climate, which has been changing, and That's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is our incidence of severe weather events or severe rains, where we're getting more than 4 inches over a 24-hour period, that's increased. So small grains are the kind of crops that do not do well when the weather gets very hot. So they need to be planted as early as is possible in the spring and harvested as early as is possible in the summer when they're ready, when they're physiologically mature. That's what we say. What has happened is that the days where you can actually work in the spring, those windows are shrinking, which means that often small grains are planted later, and the potential for them to yield as good as they possibly could is lost because of those strange and stochastic weather patterns in the early spring. So this confluence of different factors is making it a real challenge to grow small grains in the state. And then, you know, the other factors of, again, when and where we get periods of heat, that's all of that is changing. So as we're losing information about how to grow this crop, things are also becoming more variable. So that's kind of a perfect storm of bad conditions for growing small grains in the state of Iowa.
But they're so important in a long-term rotation, be able to grow small grains effectively. They provide so many different benefits in that long-term rotation. I couldn't grow organic corn, for instance, if I didn't have a strong long-term rotation that included a small grain. So it's very important to the whole system to be able to grow small grains effectively.
So how the small grains differ, this is the thing I know about. I know less about policy, so I'll speak to this, is that because they're grown at different times of the year, right? So they smother out weeds that could come up mid-season. Right. And small grains are often grown with forage legumes. So small grains are planted at the same time as red clovers or alfalfas. So after the small grains are harvested, you've got this lush stand of alfalfa or clover. So those plants are able to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and add it to the soil. So they improve soil fertility. So when you take away the small grain, you're not just taking away the grain itself or straw, but you're taking away the potential to suppress weeds naturally. Or ecologically, let's say, you know, you could reduce or eliminate herbicides. When you take away small grains, you're taking away potential for nitrogen fixation from the atmosphere, which means that farmers are stuck in the cycle of adding synthetic inputs, right? So when you take just that 1 year of the rotation away, you're taking away the potential of minimizing and reducing inputs. And we know about all the associated environmental issues with all those inputs and the misuse of them. So again, landscape level change has really affected how Iowa looks and what it's able to do and isn't able to do.
We were talking about forage grains. That sounds like you could put cattle or sheep or some other animal out to
be. Yeah, and the transformation of our livestock industry in Iowa has impacted us in this way as well. If we don't have livestock on as a part of our agriculture system, it's much harder to integrate small grains into the long-term rotations as well. And from a current policy standpoint, you know, I was trying very hard to develop strategies to clean up our water. And part of the reason we need to do that is because we just have fewer acres that are in pasture and fewer acres that are in long-term rotations that had things growing on the soil at different times than corn and soybeans. So they'd be taking up nutrients rather than letting them go through the soil and into our waterways. So as our system became more narrow, what happens anytime you do that, there are going to be side effects. And one of the effects that's happened is that as we've concentrated on corn and soybean production for a lot of economic reasons over the years, one of the results is that we have fewer roots on the ground at other times of the year, less pasture, less oats, less wheat. And the result of that is that a lot of those nutrients, instead of being used by those roots, have left our ground and gone into our water and caused our nitrate issues. And no one system is going to work for everyone. But farmers are smart enough to know that we need things that work on individual farms for individual farmers under their circumstances. So no one's saying that these things need to be implemented in the same way by every farmer. But we do need to put in policies in place that incentivize farmers to use these practices like cover crops that put living roots on the ground at different times of the year. And all those practices contribute to a broader system that can lead to cleaner water for Iowa.
I think there are some great opportunities in the future, and I don't want to be pessimistic, so I want to say this. I think there are great opportunities for urban and rural residents, so farmers and city citizens, to collaborate. I think there needs to be greater awareness around these issues, and that gets obfuscated sometimes because we come from such different places. But what I've liked about working with Aaron is that it gives me a greater perspective of what farmers are doing and what the limitations are. So as a researcher, that's really important. And I think in general, we need more of that, more collaboration across these different divides. I think that would be very beneficial. I think farmers can be really great stewards in Iowa. And I think we need to make sure that we create policy scenarios that are not unduly rigid, but are also holding folks accountable. And I think the farmers I've worked with and talked with at the Iowa Farmers Union, they're open to those sorts of ideas, and they're working hard at promoting the policies that are necessary to make that movement a reality.
And that's why we fought so hard for the Leopold Center this last legislative session. The Leopold Center was a leader in the world for innovative, sustainable agriculture. And they did it so well in part because the research was so farmer-focused from the very inception of what type of research to look for, what type of projects to actually fund, and how those projects were implemented. We're all very much guided by farmers. And that just it's very hard to replicate in any other way. So we fought extremely hard for the Leopold Center, and that's why we want to be as supportive as we can of the Leopold Center efforts, and that's why we're trying to offer a good incentive for folks to become Farmers Union members, because we want to also support the Leopold Center.
I understand that your goal is just 300 new members, and you will welcome non-farmers.
Absolutely. We need to build ties across the entire state of Iowa. Farmers with non-farmers, consumers with farmers, across all sorts of spectrums, we need to be working together on this.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've been talking about the future of farming. In a few minutes, we'll return to talk about young farmers and what their prospects are for doing the kind of farming that inspires them. But I'd like to take a short break and to introduce a new weekly show produced by Practical Farmers of Iowa, an organization that fosters the kind of farmer collaboration that our guests have been talking about. PFI was founded in the mid-80s, about the same time as the Leopold Center. Unlike the Iowa Farmers Union, it doesn't take policy positions or do political lobbying. It seeks to bring farmers together to share their common problems, whether they are organic farmers or conventional farmers, whether they grow row crops or vegetables. The organization doesn't take sides on the cultural divide Fred Kirschenmann told us about, but they do agree that farmers need to work together to move forward. So mark this down. On Saturday morning at 9 a.m., listen for On Farm with Nick Odey of the Practical Farmers of Iowa. The show will be weekly through the summer and fall, through the growing season and into harvest. PFI will have field days and conferences to announce and much more that will be of special interest to farmers. But, as Fred Kirschenmann points out, farming is important to anyone who eats. So that's all of us. How do you see young farmers getting started in with these practices? If they learn them, for example, in sustainable agriculture, where can they go to find farms?
That's another really good question. And one of the things, again, that most of our culture, at least in the developed world, are not very well aware of, and particularly not in the United States, and that is that we have a very serious problem emerging in terms of future farmers. USDA, of course, does their statistical analysis every 5 years, and they always come up with a figure like we have 2.1, 2.2 million farmers. And that doesn't sound too bad, right? As Mike Duffy at University has been saying for some time, the problem with that is that the way they come up with that statistic is that they're still using a definition of a farm that was developed back in 1947, which is any place that produces $1,000 in gross sales, or that would have produced $1,000 in gross sales if that place had maximized its full production capacity. And so when you break that actually down, and the last data that he pulled together that way was in the 2007 census data, and in 2007, 70% of our total agriculture sales were produced by just 192,442 farms in this country. Almost half of our farmers now are over age 60, 30% are over age 70, and only 6% are under age 35. So if we don't begin to deal with the question that you just asked, and that is how do young farmers, you know, begin to be able to get actively engaged in farming in terms of, you know, being a partner with nature, we're going to have a serious, serious problem. Right now, the young farmers that I know, and there are many of them, one of the great gifts we have right now is that there are so many of these millennials who want to farm. They don't want to raise commodities. They want to raise food for people. And they're not particularly interested in just making a lot of wealth for themselves. They want to have the kinds of relationships where they can produce this food and make it available. So they're not looking for 1,000 acres to grow corn and soybeans. They're looking for, you know, 4 or 5 acres, at the most 10 acres, grow vegetables and fruits, in some cases animals for meat. You know, it's not that there aren't a lot of challenges there, but they've demonstrated that it can be done. And so, again, that's some of the good news.
So, David, what are the policy issues that you see as a potential young farmer, as a potential sustainable farmer? And you might say how that makes you different from the average ag graduate from Iowa State.
Sure. Land use and land ownership has changed drastically in Iowa. We know that because we can look around and see how things have changed. And if we look at historical records, we know that Iowa once looked a lot different. There's more natural vegetation, more prairie vegetation, more small grains, more pastures, less corn and soybean. We've seen over time, Aaron talked about the aggregation of larger and larger parcels of land to fewer and fewer landowners, many of whom are no longer farming and are living in urban areas. So I think a key issue right now is that those who don't own land, and there are many farmers who are renting from year to year, have little to no incentive to farm in any other way than the way that we're farming now. And because, you know, if we think back to Ezra Taft Benson, we think about these ideas of get big or get out. We've gone down this trajectory where in order to make ends meet as a farmer, you need to farm more and more acreage and you're making less and less profit. So again, it's this idea of economies of scale, that you're spreading your profit over larger and larger acreage. And I think what becomes problematic about that is that we lose a caring for the landscape. So you're not able to adequately manage the landscape as carefully as you could in the past when you were farming smaller acres of land. So I think this idea that we need to find a way of incentivizing young people and those who want to farm more carefully on smaller acreage and can become better stewards. So I think we need to rethink this kind of rental agreement. We need to rethink how we're allowing young farmers to get on the landscape. But again, this basic idea that renters of land in Iowa that are young farmers are locked into a system and have minimal to no agency as to what they do and what they grow. For me, that's the crux of this whole problem.
What do you see that can be done about that on a policy level?
This is a huge question that I don't think I can answer in a simple sentence or two. I think we need to really reconsider what rental agreements look like in the state of Iowa. And I think a year-to-year rental agreement or a lease with a landowner that lives in Chicago or Arizona or Florida, I think that's a detriment to the state of Iowa, and that's a detriment to sound farming practices and rural communities. I think if we could expand rental agreements to go more than, let's say, 5 or 10 years, I think farmers would have a greater opportunity to go to landowners and say, hey, I can optimize net returns over 3 years by growing other crops, by reducing my input costs. But I can only do that over 3 years or 6 years or 9 years. I can't do that in a given year. I think farmers need to have the flexibility with rental agreements to be able to do that.
So, David, what are the policy issues that you see as a potential young farmer, as a potential sustainable farmer? And you might say how that makes you different from the average ag graduate from Iowa State?
Sure. Land use and land ownership has changed drastically in Iowa. We know that because we can look around and see how things have changed. And if we look at historical records, we know that Iowa once looked a lot different. There's more natural vegetation, more prairie vegetation, more small grains, more pastures, less corn and soybean. Aaron talked about the aggregation of larger and larger parcels of land to fewer and fewer landowners, many of whom are no longer farming and are living in urban areas. So I think a key issue right now is that those who don't own land, and there are many farmers who are renting from year to year, have little to no incentive to farm in any other way than the way that we're farming now. And because if we think back to Ezra Taft Benson, we think about these ideas of get big or get out, we've gone down this trajectory where in order to make ends meet as a farmer, you need to farm more and more acreage, and you're making less and less profit. So again, it's this idea of economies of scale, that you're spreading your profit over larger and larger acreage. And I think what becomes problematic about that is that we lose a caring for the landscape. So you're not able to adequately manage the landscape as carefully as you could in the past when you were farming smaller acres of land. So I think this idea that we need to find a way of incentivizing young people and those who want to farm more carefully on smaller acreage and can become better stewards. So I think we need to rethink this kind of rental agreement. We need to rethink how we're allowing young farmers to get on the landscape. But again, this basic idea that renters of land in Iowa that are young farmers are locked into a system and have minimal to no agency as to what they do and what they grow. For me, that's the crux of this whole problem.
What do you see that can be done about that on a policy level?
This is a huge question that I don't think I can answer in a simple sentence or two. I think we need to really reconsider what rental agreements look like in the state of Iowa. And I think a year-to-year rental agreement or a lease with a landowner that lives in Chicago or Arizona or Florida, I think that's a detriment to the state of Iowa, and that's a detriment to sound farming practices in rural communities. I think if we could expand rental agreements to go more than, let's say, 5 or 10 years, I think farmers would have a greater opportunity to go to landowners and say, hey, I can optimize net returns over 3 years by growing other crops, by reducing my input costs, but I can only do that over 3 years or 6 years or 9 years. I can't do that in a given year. I think farmers need to have the flexibility with rental agreements to be able to do that.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we'll end today's show on a lighter note with a production at Webster City Community Theater. It is adapted from the best-selling book, Growing Up Lutheran, What Does This Mean? By Janet Lettens-Martin and Suzanne Johnson-Nelson. This may not sound like the stuff of hilarious musical comedy, but according to a decade of theatergoers throughout the country, it is. Let's hear from Will Groves, the director. Will, what's the play that's coming up next weekend?
It's called Church Basement Ladies. It's a musical about growing up, about church change in the 1960s. There are four women of four different ages. It goes from the college-aged girl who is home for various events that take place in the life of the church during this time. It's over a four-year period. And during that time, she goes from young college student on up to being married in the last scene. The other protagonists are her mother, another older lady, as kind of the church maintenance person when things go wrong. She's there to help fix things. And then there's, of course, the crusty old curmudgeon who's in charge of the entire kitchen and runs it like a camp. And basically it revolves around their lives at various stages, various church events, a wedding on down to a funeral, various other church fundraiser to raise money for a furnace and various events in the life of a church.
Well, you said this was the 60s. The 60s was pretty famous for things like the generation gap and student protests and older people feeling that the young were really going astray. Is there any of that in the play?
It's basically what it's about, the tumultuous times of the 60s, not only in society, as you just mentioned, but in the life of the church itself.
Are there any men in this play, like a minister?
Yes, there is. There are four women and the minister. His basic goal is to stay out of their way and let them pretty much run things. And it takes place in the.
You said this was a musical.
There are 16 musical numbers in the whole show.
Now, you said this was written to reflect the real experiences of these women who presumably were together in the 60s. So it must be a fairly old show.
It was actually first written, I think, in 2006 when this show was first presented. And there have been four other shows written after that, sequels to the 1960s, and then there was one that was written prequel, which took place in the 1950s, but it was all based on this group of church basement ladies. So even though it was takes place in the 50s and 60s, it was just written within the last 10 years.
Well, can you give us any idea of a plot line?
Well, the plot line basically is just following the life of the church, a four-year period from 1964 to 1968. Really, it explores, I guess, the relationships of the four protagonists in the show, kind of follows them on through their life, as they're organizing the food, they're solving the problems of the church, trying to navigate the church and themselves through this tumultuous time in the 60s.
Is there anything you could say that would make the listener think, oh, I really want to drive up to Webster City and see that play?
I would say that you would recognize people in the show. You would recognize the character. Say, oh, Mavis looks like Helen that I remember from 50 years ago in rural Iowa. Even in Ames, I'm sure it's the same. The infrastructure of the church revolves around a group of women who are really pitching in and doing all the dirty work, the heavy lifting, the keeping the congregation and the people involved, and you will just recognize those characters. You will also enjoy the music. As I said, it ranges all the way from funny to poignant. I could say that you will enjoy the show. If you don't, I would personally give you your money back. So I guess I could put a money back guarantee on it if you come.
Well, that's a pretty high risk leap of faith.
It's not high risk because I know the show and the people involved, and I know the theme of the show is something that's universal. It's appealing to a very wide audience.
Well, I suppose that the church basement ladies wouldn't really approve of placing bets on their performance. A raffle, maybe.
Yeah, we could do a raffle.
That was Will Groves, director of Church Basement Ladies, opening this Friday at the Webster City Community Theater. To reserve your tickets, call 515-832-4456 or order online at WCCT. Showtimes are 7 p.m. July 7th and 8th, and the following weekend, starting Thursday the 12th, the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th, and at 2 p.m. on July 9th and 16th, that's Sundays. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franson. Other voices you heard were Fred Kirschenmann, Aaron Healy, David Weisberger, and Will Groves. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With headline news at the top of the hour. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.